The Zen Manifesto, Freedom from Oneself, Number 2. An Osho talk given spontaneously at an outdoor meeting to an international audience of thousands of people.
One day, on his way to see Matsu, Tanka Tenen met an old man with a boy and asked them where they lived. The old man answered, "Above is the sky, below is the earth." Tanka said, "How about if the sky crumbled away and the earth fell to pieces?" The old man said, Ah. The boy drew a deep breath, and Tanka said, "If there were no father, no child would be born." The old man and the child entered the mountains and were seen no more. Once, Tanka Tenen was lying on the Tenshin Bridge. Lord Taiko, who was in charge of the bridge, came out and warned Tanka that he had better move, but Tanka didn't get up. Taiko asked why he didn't listen to him. After a few moments, Tanka said, "I am a monk of nothing." Taiko was taken aback by Tanka Tenen's response, and from then on provided him with clothing and a daily meal. After the incident, Tanka Tenen was venerated by the whole city.
Praise. The first question. In Thomas Merton's view, Zen is not a systematic explanation of life. It is not an ideology. It is not a worldview. It is not a theology of revelation and salvation. It is not a mystique. It is not a way of ascetic perfection. It is not mysticism, as it is understood in the West. In fact, it fits no convenient category of ours. Hence, all our attempts to tag it and dispose of it with labels like pantheism, quietism, illuminism, Pelagianism, must be completely incongruous. But the chief characteristic of Zen is that it rejects all systematic elaborations in order to get back as far as possible to the pure, unarticulated and unexplained ground of direct experience, The direct experience of what? Life itself. Has Thomas Merton got it? It is a very sad story about Thomas Merton. Perhaps he was one of the persons in the West who has come closest to Zen. He had a sensibility of a poet. The others are approaching Zen from their intellect, their mind. Thomas Merton is approaching Zen through his heart. He feels it. But he could not live the direct experience he is talking about. He would have been the first Zen master in the West. But he was prevented by the Catholic Church. Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk under the Vatican. The Trappist monks are the most self-torturing ascetics in Christianity. Perhaps that's why they are called Trappist, trapped forever. Thomas Merton wrote beautiful poetry, and he asked again and again that he wanted to go to Japan and to live in a Zen monastery, to have the direct experience of Zen. But the permission was refused. Almost half a dozen times, again and again he was refused. If he has really understood Zen, he would not have bothered even to ask the permission. Who is the Vatican? Who is the Pope? Asking permission from unenlightened people by a Zen master is simply not heard of. And he followed the orders from the Vatican and from his own abbot of the monastery. He has been reading as much as was available in English about Zen. Finally, he had a chance, but he did not understand the way that organized religions work. There was going to be a Catholic conference of missionaries in Bangkok, Thailand. He asked the permission to attend the conference. Deep in his heart, he was going to Bangkok to attend the conference just in order so that from Bangkok he can have an entry into Japan without asking anybody's permission. But the Pope and the Vatican leaders and his abbot, they were all aware of his continuously asking for going to a Zen monastery. The last day of the conference in Bengal, he spoke, and he spoke about Zen, and he also mentioned that he would love to go to Japan from Bengal. That very night he was found dead. And without informing anybody, his body was embalmed immediately, without any autopsy, without knowing the cause of his death. After you have embalmed a body, there is no possibility of autopsy. There is every reason to suspect that he was murdered by a poison. To prevent him from going to a Zen monastery. Murder has been the argument of the so-called religions. This is not a religious attitude at all. If he wanted to experience Zen, any religious man would have allowed him to go. That what happens in Zen, no master ever rejects any disciple's interest into some other Zen monk, into some other monastery, maybe belonging to a different branch, Soto or Rinzai. It is gracefully given not only to those who are inquiring to go somewhere else, but even the master himself, if he feels that some other master will be more appropriate, some other path leading to the direct experience will be more fitting to the disciple, he himself sends his disciples to other monasteries. This is a totally different world of Zen. No competitiveness, no question of conversion. Thomas Merton's murder shows the poverty of Catholicism and Christianity. Why they were so afraid? The fear was that Thomas Merton has already praised Zen, and although he is living in the monastery, it seems he is wavering between Zen and Christianity. To give him a chance to go to Japan and have a direct experience under a master may be a dangerous thing. He may be involved into Zen for his whole life. And these so-called religions are so jealous. They don't have any compassion for individual growth, freedom. Thomas Merton's murder is not only Thomas Merton's murder, it should make every Christian aware that Christianity is not a religion. Deep down, it is more interested in gathering numbers. Numbers have their own politics. The greater number of followers you have, the greater power to dominate And they are always afraid that anybody who leaves their fold is betraying them. But it is absolutely certain that for Thomas Merton, has already in his heart felt the immense need of Zen. Christianity was no more satisfying, and he has been his whole life a monk in the monastery. But slowly, slowly, as he became aware of Zen, he could see Christianity is not at all a religion. Fictions, lies, beliefs, but not a direct experience. The very idea of Zen as a non-systematic, individualist approach to truth in a direct way, not through theology, not through any belief, not through any philosophy, but through meditation, was attracting him immensely. But it was not yet an experience. He is far better than Suzuki, than Alan Watts, than Paul Rapes, then Hubert Benoit, and then many others who have written about Zen. Thomas Merton comes to the closest, because he is not speaking through the head, he is speaking through the heart of a poet. But the heart is only just in the middle between the head and the being. Unless you reach to the being, you don't have the experience yourself. But he was a sensitive man. He could manage to state things which he has not experienced. His statement is beautiful, but it shows clearly that he has not experienced it himself. This is his understanding. Of course, far deeper than any other Western scholar about Zen. If it has been really a direct experience to him as he is talking about, he would not have cared about anybody's permission. He would not have cared about Christianity. He would have come out of that fold, which was just a slavery and nothing else. Because he never came out of the fold, it shows he is hanging in the middle. He is not yet certain. He has not tasted the truth. He has only heard about it, read about it, and felt that there seems to be a different approach, altogether different than Christianity. But Christianity was still keeping its hold over him. He could not be a rebel. That's where he fell. Completely failed. A man of Zen is basically rebellious. He was not rebellious. He was a very obedient person. And obedience is another name of slavery. A beautiful name that does not hurt you. But it is spiritual slavery. His asking for 6 times and being refused, and he still remained in the fold, shows clearly that he is spiritually a slave. although he is showing deep interest in Zen, but it is at the most deeper than the mind, but not deep enough to reach to the being. He remained hanging in the middle. Perhaps now in his new life, either he may be here or in Japan. Most probably he may be here amongst you, because that was his last wish before he died. As the conference ended and he went to his bed, immediately he was poisoned. The last wish must have been while he was dying, thinking about Zen, going to Japan, being with a master. He has lived under Christianity his whole life, but it has not fulfilled him. It has not made him enlightened. It has only been a consolation. Only fools can be deceived by consolations and lies and fictions. A man of that intense sensitivity as Thomas Merton could not be befooled. But a lifelong obedience turned into a spiritual slavery. He tried to sneak out from Bangkok because there was no need to ask the abbot of the monastery, there was no need to ask the pope. He could have simply gone from Bangkok, but these so-called religions are murderous. They must have been ready that if he shows any interest in Japan and does not go back to his monastery directly from Bangkok as the conference ends, the murderers must have been already there. And because he mentioned in his last speech to the conference that he is immensely interested in Zen and he would like to go to Japan from here, this statement became his death. So it is not only Ayatollah Khomeini. There have been murders and murders, century after century, of people who wanted to get out of the slavery and seek and search the truth on their own, who wanted to get rid of all systems, who wanted to have a direct experience of life. His words are beautiful, but they are empty words, because there is no supporting experience behind them. I will read those words again. Zen is not a systematic explanation of life. But this can be said very easily, reading by anybody books about Zen. It is not a systematic explanation of life. In fact, it is not an explanation at all. That makes the difference. He is denying Zen is not a systematic explanation of life. I say unto you, Zen is not an explanation at all about life or existence. It is experience, not an explanation. It is not an ideology. This can be said by anyone who is reading a book on Zen. But it is so apparently stated by so many people who have only intellectual understanding that it is not a great indication that Thomas Merton has had any experience. Zen certainly is not an ideology. It is not a world view. All these are different words for the same thing, a systematic explanation, an ideology, a world view, a theology of revelation and salvation. He is simply being tautological. He is saying the same thing again and again in different words. It is not a mystique. There he is wrong. It is, although it is not stated. That's why he thought it is not a mystique. It is the greatest mystique, but it is not said, because it cannot be said. Because it is not said ever, he thought that it is not a mystique. These small things indicate that he is just read about it. Because nowhere it is said it is a mystique, because no master ever indicated into words that it is a mystique, he thinks it is not a mystique. It is. It is the greatest mystique, the greatest mystery, the greatest miracle. But to say it into words has not been the way of Zen. It attracts people, takes away their ideologies, their theologies, their religions, and leaves them absolutely fresh at the very center of your being, without saying anything, you experience the mystique, you experience the mystery of existence and life. But because it is an experience, in Zen they don't even use the word experience. They use the word experiencing. Because the experience is not something dead and complete. It is a river flowing, flowing, alive, moving. The experience indicates that it has become complete. Anything that becomes complete becomes dead. And Zen is the most alive thing in the world. Hence it cannot be said that it is an experience. We have to invent a word, experiencing. Instead of river, rivering. That gives it a clear-cut idea that river is not static. It is moving on the way, always on the way, moving eternally, falling into the ocean, rising into the clouds, falling into the rain on the mountains, again the river, moving in a circle of tremendous aliveness, never stopping anywhere. There is no full stop in Zen. And all our words, experience, knowledge, understanding, give the illusion of a full stop. We have to change our nouns into verbs. Verbs come closer to life. We use the word life, but we should rather use the word living. That comes closer. Moment to moment living. Life seems to be something dead, already has completed its course, has come to an end, to the graveyard. Zen is certainly a mystique, in fact the only mystique there is. But it is not being said. It is kept a secret, so that you don't go inside your being with a certain idea. You go absolutely clean and fresh. You will find the mystery, the immense mystery of life. But Zen's absolute approach is not to give you any idea what you are going to find. The reason is very scientific. If you have any idea what you are going to find, which all the religions give you, the mind has the capacity to create a hallucination of the idea. Then the idea becomes a reality to you. Christians experience Christ, Buddhists experience Buddha, Hindus experience Krishna. It never happens to a Hindu that Christ comes. It never happens to a Christian that Muhammad comes. It's strange. Muhammad comes only to those who believe in Muhammad. Once in a while, it will be good for these people to enter into somebody's experience. In fact, it will be absolutely right to convert. If Christ appears to a Hindu, the Hindu will become Christian. If Krishna appears to a Christian, the Christian will turn into Hare Krishna, Hare Rama movement. But it never happens, it cannot happen, because you are carrying a certain idea so fixed that your whole mind starts creating a dream. The mind has the capacity of dreaming, hallucinating, imagining. And if you constantly are working on one single idea, sooner or later it becomes such a fixed program that when you look in silence, you find suddenly Christ arising. And that fulfills your idea. It is a vicious circle. Because you experience Christ arising before your mind, your belief in Christ becomes stronger. Now it is no more just a belief, you have experienced also. Because it becomes stronger, more possibility of Christ coming to you closer. Every time Christ appears to you, he will be more solid, more alive, more close. And every time his appearance, you are getting a feedback to your belief system. It is becoming stronger and fanatic. Soon you will be almost insane. You will start talking to Christ. Not only that, you will start talking, he will answer. Anybody watching you will see that you are doing both the things. You are asking the question and you are answering the question. Anybody watching to you will be able to see that you are just behaving in an insane way. There is nobody you are talking to, but to yourself you have gone so deep in the hallucination with such strength and continuous feedback that it is Christ who is talking. You can find such mad people in every madhouse who are sitting and talking. And you know that there is nobody. And the strangest phenomenon is which mind is capable of. When the person will ask a question, his voice will be different. And when he will answer the question, his voice will be different, booming, coming from the beyond. And this whole game he is playing alone. There is nobody to answer. In a madhouse, a madman was keeping his eyes, his ears fixed by the side of a wall. He was keeping his eyes down and his ears touching to the wall. The superintendent came many times, but he was completely fixed in his posture. Finally, he could not resist his temptation. What is the matter? He asked the fellow, he said, shh. But the superintendent said, what are you doing? He said, I am trying to listen. You can give a try. So the superintendent came and listened to the wall, and there was nothing to listen. And he said, I can't hear a thing. The madman said, neither I can. But one never knows. I will continue till I start listening. And if you continue till you start listening, you are going completely insane. All religions have been driving their saints, their monks into insanity. This world is not without any reason in a mess. The religions are absolutely responsible for it. It is not a way of ascetic perfection. Because he was following an ascetic way of perfection, he could see that Zen is different. It gives no discipline. The Trappist monk lives under such a strict discipline which is unbelievable. I have told you the story. A man entered in one of the most prominent Trappist monastery. And the abbot said, do you know our rule? That for 7 years you have not to say a single word. Only after 7 years you can state anything you want, need, anything you want to inquire, just a small piece of talking. And then for 7 years again you have to be silent. The man was determined to follow the discipline, so he accepted. And he was shown his cell. He went into the cell and he saw that the glass is broken. So for 7 years he was suffering from cold, suffering from rain, because the rain was coming directly through the window, and he could not say a single word. He has to wait for 7 years. He waited for 7 years. And after 7 years he went to the monk and said, "My window is broken." The monk said, "That's enough. You go back. For 7 years, no more words. The window will be repaired." The window was repaired, but in 7 years, the mattress has gotten completely rotten because continuous rain was coming in, even snowflakes were coming in. Suddenly he saw that he did not mention about the mattress. My God, now 7 years again. And the mattress has gathered all kinds of cockroaches, spiders, because the window was open. And this was a good shelter for cockroaches. 7 years of continuous suffering with cockroaches. And then he again went to the abbot and said, "You repair the window, but the mattress is absolutely rotten." He said, "Go back to your cell, a new mattress will be sent." And the people who brought the new mattress, they pulled out the old one, cleaned the cell, but the new mattress was bigger than the cell. They somehow forced it, and because they were forcing it, the glass of the window was broken. Now again begins the same story. 14 years have passed, again he is back to the zero. The first day he has entered, this was the situation. 7 years he has to wait again the rain, and he is getting old and sick and continuously having fever, but he cannot speak. After 7 years, when he reached to the abbot said, "Shut up!" Before he spoke, that for 20 years I have never heard anything from you except complaints, complaints, complaints. Get out of the monastery. The poor fellow, after 21 years wasting in a Trappist monastery, was thrown out, sick, old, exhausted, 21 years continuous torture. Thomas Merton was living in a Trappist monastery. Obviously, he could see that Zen does not give you any discipline. It is not ascetic. And he could see what he has been doing to himself and what other Trappists are doing to themselves. It is sheer masochism, self-torture, in the name of ascetic way of life. It is not a way of life, it is a way of death. It is slow suicide, slow poisoning. But his statement will be detected by any man who has a direct experience of Zen. He says it is not a way of ascetic perfection. The implication is it is a way of perfection without asceticism. It is not a way of perfection at all. Zen is evolution. Endless evolution. Perfection is a dead end of the road. There is no more to go. In Zen, there is always the infinite and the eternal available. You cannot adjust it. In fact, slowly, slowly, as you go on the way, the way is not adjusted, you start dispersing and disappearing. Suddenly you find one day you are no more. Only existence is. It is not perfection at all. It is not salvation. It is dissolution. It is disappearance. It is melting like ice into the ocean. He goes on saying, it is not mysticism as it is understood in the West. In the West, it is understood as mysticism. That does not mean it is not mysticism. Certainly it is not the mysticism that arises out of the mind as a philosophical point of view. It is pure mysticism, not originating in the mind, but arising from your very sources of life. It blossoms into mysterious flowers, releasing mysterious, absolutely unknown fragrances into existence. It is mysticism, but it is not an ism. It is not a philosophy. It is not a creed and cult. Again and again you have to fall back towards direct experience. He says, in fact, it fits no convenient category of ours. All his statements are beautiful, but something is missing. And that missing link you will find only if you have the experience, then you can compare. Otherwise, Thomas Merton will look absolutely right, a man of Zen. He is not. He wanted to be. If he was, there was no need to go to Japan. I have never gone to Japan. In fact, in Japanese Zen monasteries, my books are being read, prescribed in Zen universities. But I have never gone to Japan. I don't have to. Buddha himself never went to Japan. Mahakashyapa was not born in Japan. His desire to go to Japan shows that he has seen one thing clearly, that Christianity does not work. And he is searching for some new approach that works. His statement that in fact it fits no convenient category of ours is true. But it is not only categories of ours, it does not fit in any kind of category. It is beyond categories. Neither Christian categories, nor Hindu, nor Mohammedan, nor Jaina, it does not fit in any category. It is so original, you cannot make it fit into any category. The original is always individual. It is not a category. Do you think I fit in any category? All categories are against me. And the reason why they are against, because I don't fit with them. And I have no desire to fit with anybody. I am sufficient unto myself. I don't need any religion, I don't need any philosophy, I don't need any category. In other words, I am a category in myself. Zen will not fit into any category because it is a category in itself. And such a rebellious category, such an unsystematic category, that all kinds of wild flowers are accepted equal with the roses and with the lotuses. It does not matter which, whether it is a lotus or a rose or just a wild flower. The only thing that matters is flowering. All have flowered to their potential. That's where they are all equal. Otherwise, their colors are different, their beauties are different, their fragrances are different. Few may not have any fragrance at all. So they don't fit in one category. But as far as flowering is concerned, they have all flowered, blossomed to their totality. Whatever was hidden has become a reality. What was a dream in the plant has blossomed as a reality. Zen is a blossoming of your potential, and everybody has a different potential. So when you blossom as a Zen man, you have a unique individuality. You don't fit with any category. Not only Christian categories, that's what Thomas Merton means. In fact, it fits no convenient category of ours. But I have to say to you, it does not fit any category at all, yours or ours or anybody else. It is the beyond of mind. All categories belong to the mind. This is the only rebellion against mind, going beyond. This is the only revolution against the self, going into no self, into anatta. This is ultimate freedom from all kinds of bondages, prisons and categories and isms and ideologies and worldviews and philosophies. It is an absolute freedom from all that mind can create and mind can understand. It is also free from the heart. The heart can understand something deeper than the mind, but Zen is far more deeper than the heart. Heart can be just an overnight stay while you are going towards your being. Your heart, your arts, your music, your dance, your poetry, your painting, your sculpture can be just one night's halt. But you have to go deeper. You have to reach to the very roots of your life, from where you are getting every moment nourishment, to the point where you are joined with existence. You are no more separate. Hence all our attempts, says Thomas Merton, to tag it and dispose of it with labels like pantheism, quietism, illuminism, pelagianism, must be completely incongruous. This is a very simple understanding which need not have any direct experience. And he comes to the point, he says, but the chief characteristic of Zen is that it rejects all systematic elaborations in order to get back as far as possible to the pure, unarticulated and unexplained ground of direct experience. The direct experience of what? Life itself. A beautiful statement, but empty. A plastic flower with no fragrance and with no life in it. Otherwise, why he wanted to go to Japan? If he had that this direct experience he is talking about, there was no need to go to Japan, and there was no need to remain in a Trappist monastery. He should have been a man of freedom. But he could never attain that freedom. He was longing for it. He was desiring for it. And you desire only because you don't have it. If you have it, you don't desire it. And you have asked, has Thomas Merton got it? Not yet. But perhaps in this life, after being murdered by the Christians, it is a well-known fact to the people who have known the direct experience that your last thought before you die is going to be your first thought when you are born and you grow up. As you start having intelligence, your last thought of the past life is going to suddenly pop. It has been hiding itself inside you. It is just like the last thought when you go to the bed. Just watch, what is the last thought? Or perhaps it is better to create the last thought so you are clearly aware. For example, you simply think of zero. Go on watching the zero. So it is visual also, and the thought is inside zero, 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 and sleep starts coming. And when the sleep is coming, it's still a far away echo, zero, zero, zero goes on. Once the sleep settles, you forget about the word zero. Then remember in the early morning when you are feeling awake, don't open your eyes, just wait a little. Within moments, the first thought in the morning will be zero. That will give you the idea that although you had forgotten about zero whole night, 8 hours, but it was continuously moving as an undercurrent. Otherwise, how you find it exactly in the morning, the first thought? And the same happens with death, because death is nothing but a deeper sleep. The last thought, the last desire is going to be your first thought, your first desire as you will become mature enough to have thoughts, it will immediately come to your mind. So in Tibet they have a special ceremony for dying people called Bardo. The person is dying and the masters of Bardo recite certain experiences that are going to happen to you, that you will be born in a certain womb of a special kind, that you will be born as an intelligent being, that your first thought will be how to find the truth, how to become a Buddha. They go on repeating, the man is dying. He is going deeper and deeper into his sleep. They go on repeating till they feel the man is dead. They have given him the last thought. Perhaps he would not have been able to have this last thought by himself, because his last thought may be money, his last thought may be sex, his last thought may be anything that he has been desiring and has not been able to get: power, prestige, respectability. One never knows what last thought will be. It will be the one that you have not been able to materialize in your life and you are disappointed. That will bubble up, pop up in your head, and that will drive you into a new life. That will be the determining factor for your new phase, your new journey. The Tibetan enlightened people found it that it is better not to depend on the person. It is better to create the aroma, the atmosphere in which he forgets all about money and sex, power and prestige, fame and name. And they go on repeating Bardo in such a singing voice that it is impossible for him not to hear it. I had one famous doctor in Jabalpur, Dr. Bharat, a Bengali doctor, but the most famous physician in that part of the country. He was the president of the Rotary Club. That's how I came to know him, because he requested me to address the Rotary Club. So he had come to my house and took me in his car and has listened to me for the first time in the Rotary Club and became very deeply interested in me. He used to come to see me once in a while, was reading books I have suggested to him, because he wanted to read something about Zen, something about Tibetan mysticism, something about Sufism, something about Hasidism, the things that I have been talking to him. So he came to the point to know about Bardo. He said, "What is Bardo?" I said, "I will come to your clinic and give you a trial." He said, "What do you mean, you will give me a trial?" I said, "In fact, it is just the opposite. But let me come to your clinic." So I went to his clinic and I told him that you give me the chloroform. He said, "What?" I said, "You just give me the chloroform and I will go on repeating 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you just listen at what number I stop. And when I will be coming back, when you remove the chloroform mask, you just listen to me. It will be the same number where I had stopped, in a reverse order. He was a little worried. First he said, now we have stopped using chloroform. I said, you will have to if you want to understand the Bardha. He said, but it is dangerous. I said, don't be worried, it is not dangerous. So I persuaded him. He put me under the mask and I started repeating the numbers 1, 2, 3, and I was watching inside that my voice is becoming slower and slower and slower, and that he is almost putting his ears close to my mouth to hear the last, and it was 9. And after that, I could not speak. The body was completely paralyzed. My lips won't move. After 10 minutes, he removed the mask and he waited. And as I became capable of moving my lips, he heard 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And as I was coming in a reverse order, my voice was becoming clearer and clearer. By the time I was reaching to 1, I was back. I said, this is Bardha. When you are dying, if you can manage yourself good, otherwise call me. Then I will give you the idea where to go, what kind of womb to find, what kind of parents will give you freedom, what kind of atmosphere where soon you will become intelligent and will not remain retarded, and the idea of becoming a Gautam Buddha. The idea of becoming enlightened. But he was still alive when I left Jabalpur in 1970. So I don't know what happened to the fellow. He was old. Most probably he must be dead and must be born somewhere. And I don't think he was capable to create the whole program for the new journey. Bardha is programming your whole journey. Thomas Merton must have been born in Japan or in a place where he can experience Zen without any hindrance of Christianity, without any obedience to any pope. But in the past life, when he was Thomas Merton, he was having a good contemplation about Zen that may have created the atmosphere of Bardha. And because this was his last statement in the conference, and he must have been planning while he was poisoned, tomorrow morning he was to leave for Japan. He has booked for Japan. But he was not aware that Christianity will not allow you so easily to get out of their prison. I am against all these religions for the simple reason that they have been criminals. Murderers. And they have been talking about peace, love, God. They have been talking about great words, but they don't mean. What they mean can be found only in their actions, not in their words. The second question, Thomas Merton wrote, Zen is one of the most mysterious of all spiritualities. Do you see the contradiction? Just in the first statement he was saying it is not a mystique. It is not mysticism. And now he is saying Zen is one of the most mysterious of all spiritualities. Being so full of impudent paradox that it is at first a real scandal to the rational spirit of the West, but in fact is not Zen more rational in its irrationality, being the acknowledgement that rationality has limits and we are after the unlimited than Christianity, with its miracles, Immaculate Conception and Resurrection. The first thing that Thomas Merton is not a very conscious being. He knows nothing of meditation. Without knowing meditation, you cannot be more conscious than the ordinary people. Everybody has a thin layer of consciousness. Hence, he forgets immediately that he has denied that Zen is a mystique. And immediately he comes to the point, Zen is one of the most mysterious of all spiritualities. In fact, it is simply mysterious, but it has nothing to do with spiritualities. It is far beyond than the so-called spirituality. Because what is your spirit then? Yourself. Hence, all spiritualities are centered on self-realization. And Zen is not a spiritual phenomenon at all, because it is moving beyond the spirit and beyond the self. It is going into nothingness. It is melting into the blue sky. For example, Jainism is a great spirituality. It stops at the realization of the self. Once you have realized your individuality, it stops. You become a frozen iceberg. Not melting. Gautama Buddha goes beyond than Mahavira. The iceberg has to melt. And once the iceberg melts, you are no more. So it is not even spirituality. Certainly that makes it more mysterious, but not a more mysterious spirituality. The basic of Gautam Buddha's approach is that you are not, and you have to look into this nothingness. And this nothingness is the beginning of your universal synchronicity with the very heart of existence. This dissolving into the ocean of life has never been taught by anyone else than Gautam Buddha. And since Gautam Buddha, Zen masters have taken the task in their hands. It is not a spirituality because it has no self. It is utterly mysterious because you are expected to dissolve yourself, which will look to the mind the hardest thing, but it is not. Once you are out of the mind, it is the easiest thing not to be. Shakespeare's statement, to be or not to be. All religions are in favor of the first, to be. Zen alone is there, rising high into the blue sky, declaring the phenomenon, the great mystery of not to be. To be is just an extension of your ego. Yourself is just a polished ego and nothing else. Yourself can be said your spiritual ego, pious ego, very refined, very subtle, but it is nothing but ego. Your personality is given by society. Your individuality is given by your very birth, but before the birth, you were not an individual. You were one with the womb of the mother. You never thought about being separate. You were not separate. You were nourished by the mother's blood, by mother's oxygen. You were part of the mother's body. You were joined from your navel to the mother's body. And that was your very source of life. The mother was giving you life. You did not have any individuality. So when you reach to the ultimate womb of the universe, again you will not have any individuality. Personality has to be dropped very quickly. That is only clothes given by the society to cover you, to keep you unaware of your individuality, which is more natural. Hence, all civilized cultures are against nudity. It is not just a social question. It is a question that they don't want you to know your individuality. They want you to think of yourself as a personality. Your clothes, your language, your education, your morality, your religion, your church going, your prayer, they all constitute your personality. They are the clothes which the society goes on covering you, and you forget completely about your individuality. So the first thing Zen has to do is to take away all the clothes. And the second thing it has to do to take away even the individuality and leave you into the cosmic womb, utterly one with existence. It is not spirituality. It is pure life, pure existence. But don't talk about spirituality or self-realization or salvation. They are all ego-bound. He is aware about the fact that being so full of impudent paradox, those paradoxes appear only to those who are trying to understand Zen from books. Zen is a direct transmission of the lamp. Without a master, it is a very, very rare phenomenon that somebody can become enlightened. With the master, you are already moving into an energy field, and you are nothing but energy, condensed energy. And the master is in tune with the existence. If you get in tune with the master, indirectly you are getting in tune with existence. And the moment the master sees that you are getting in tune with him, he simply moves out of the way. That's why Buddha is reported to have said a very strange thing, that if I come on your path, immediately cut my head. What he is saying is that the master at a certain point has to move out. If he does not move out, it is the duty of the disciple to push him away and go directly into the cosmos. But no master worth the salt will ever become a hindrance. Teachers can become hindrances, and Thomas Merton's teachers were hindrances. His abbot was prohibiting him, the Pope was prohibiting him, all senior monks in the monastery were prohibiting him. They were saying, what is the need? You have the Christ, you have Christianity, you have the greatest religion of the world. Why you are wanting to go to Japan? And particularly to the Zen people, which are just a small stream. If you are reading through books, you will find out they are full of paradox. But if you are studying under a master, he will dissolve the paradox. That's what I have been doing continuously. You bring the sutras, which are almost without any explanation, very paradoxical, very strange, almost absurd. My whole effort is to take that absurdity away, to take that paradox away, and make things clean and clear for you, so that you can understand at least Zen not as a paradoxical system, not self-contradictory, not irrational, but absolutely relevant to existence. Certainly, it does not follow the Aristotle's logic upon which the whole Christianity depends. The whole West finds in Aristotle the father of their whole logical mind. And Aristotle is certainly a genius as far as mind is concerned. But beyond the mind, he has no idea. Just as Thomas Merton is seeking to go to Japan to have some direct experience, Aristotle was Alexander the Great's teacher. And when Alexander was coming to conquer India, he asked his teacher, Aristotle, that would you like some special thing for you? I can bring it from India, anything you want. And what he wanted was to bring a sannyasin. One thing, he said, I have heard so much about the sannyasins and their enlightenment. If you can bring an enlightened sannyasin, that will be the real gift to me. And second, I have heard much about the Vedas of the Hindus, their scriptures. If you can bring a set of the four Vedas with an enlightened sannyasin, that will be greatest gift to me. That shows that he does not understand what enlightenment is. He does not understand what sannyas is. And he is asking a contradictory thing. A sannyasin and enlightened is against all scriptures. And he is asking for the Hindu scriptures also. He does not know that these are two contradictory things. But one thing is certain, that he has no experience of the inner world. Otherwise, he would not have asked for a sannyasin. He cannot understand what is this phenomenon of enlightenment. Your greatest logician is absolutely unaware of his own being. Nothing to say about the great being of existence. And he is still trying through his mind to figure out. Hence his request to bring the four Vedas, so that reading the Vedas, he can understand the enlightenment. Vedas are not needed for enlightenment. And you cannot understand enlightenment by reading any scripture. All that you will get will be a misunderstanding. Thomas Merton says, being so full of impudent paradox, it is not impudent paradox, that it is at first a real scandal to the rational spirit of the West. Rational spirit? He is using the word spirit in place of mind. A rational mind seems to be relevant. Rational spirit, nobody has heard of. Either you have your rationality or you have your spirit. Both cannot exist together. Once you have dropped your rationality, only spirit remains, the self remains. That is the last barrier. When the last barrier also is dropped, you are no more, and existence is, and life is, and this is Zen. You are asking, but in fact, is not Zen more rational in its irrationality? No. Zen is neither rational nor irrational, because both belong to the mind. Zen is simply beyond any duality. Rational and irrational are just another duality, like day and night, birth and death, darkness and light. Zen is simply beyond any dual conceptions. Once you are beyond mind, you cannot have any duality, any trace of duality in you. You are neither rational nor irrational. You are simply here and now, without any label. All labels are gathered by the mind. You are no more a man nor a woman. You have never been born and you have never died. All that was dreams are made of the same stuff. Your saying that being the acknowledgement that rationality has limits and we are after the unlimited. No, we are not after anything. The unlimited also becomes to the mind just the opposite of the limited. Another duality again. And we are not after anything. We are just relaxing into ourselves. After anything is always going outwards. After anything means after something which is outside you. We are not after anything. We are dropping all those processes after this and after that, after money, after power, after prestige, after self-realization, after God, all those things are dropped. We are simply relaxing and resting into our very source. You are also asking that we are after the unlimited, then Christianity, with its miracles, immaculate conception and resurrection. Christianity lives on all kinds of lies. All religions live on lies. But Christianity's lies are very apparent. Other religions have tried hard to hide their irrationalities, and sometimes you may not be able to discover where the irrationality is. For example, Jainism has no God. So the greatest lie is dissolved, and with it many other things are dissolved. There is no question of creation, and there is no question of the last judgment day, and there is no question of prophets coming from God, and there is no question of messiahs, messengers sent by God, and there is no question of a Jesus Christ being the only begotten Son of God. When there is no God, all these things disappear automatically. So Jainism seems to be more solidly rooted. Mahavir creates no miracles, does not give eyes to the blind, does not give health to sick people, does not revive the dead again into life. So there are no miracles which can create doubt in your mind that how these things are possible. These are absolutely unscientific. So Mahavir stands on a firmer ground, and it will be very difficult to find where he is hiding his irrationality. Most of the followers of Mahavira have never thought about that there can be anything irrational in Mahavira. He seems to be very rational, far more rational than Aristotle. Aristotle's logic is simply two steps, yes, no, day, night, positive, negative. Just two polarities have been taken in account, but what about the middle grounds? There are many positions between two extremes. At least there is a middle, and when there is a middle, again there is another middle on this side, and as you go on creating middles, you see within these five fingers, one middle, second middle, third middle, fourth middle. So there are 9 points, but this is not adjusted. Once you put one middle between two fingers, by both the sides of the middle, there will be two gaps again. So it is an infinite process of dividing and dividing into smaller pieces. Mahavir divides his logic into 7 pieces. That seems to be more rational than Aristotle, because Aristotle has only 2 alternatives, a very poor logic. So when you study Mahavira, you will be overwhelmed with his subtlety, and you will not find where to look for the loopholes. The loopholes are there. No religion can live without loopholes, but it is far superior than Christianity. Christianity's loopholes are just there in front of everybody. Only utterly blind people can be Christians, who cannot see even just in front of themselves. Immaculate conception, virgin birth. How an intelligent person can go on believing in virgin birth? Creation of the world. And nobody asks what God has been doing before. Completely unemployed for eternity. Just living with Holy Ghost. A strange kind of God. And suddenly, for no reason at all, 6,000 years before he created the whole world, within 6 days, do you think anybody can create this whole universe within 6 days? And if he was so creative, then why he remained for eternity absolutely impotent? And if there is a beginning to existence, there is bound to be an end. Things are very clear. Jesus Christ's miracles, walking on water, raising the dead, are apparently clear, are not scientific. Resurrection, and after resurrection, going directly alive, without any vehicle, not even a horse. Muhammad at least has his horse going up, just stops in the middle for a rest at Jerusalem. Jerusalem seems to be above the clouds, a holy city. Tired of a long journey, he rests there on a rock and then takes another jump. But at least he has the horse. Jesus has not even a horse. Goes directly, like a balloon. And without any gas. And after reaching to the paradise, he must have thrown a rope or something for his mother to hold it. And he pulls the mother also to paradise. And people go on believing in these things. And if you remove all these things, Christianity has nothing to offer. So they go on insisting that these are real, factual experiences. But the time has come when they cannot insist anymore. Jainism is far more superior, but I will tell you where are its loopholes. Its loopholes are very hidden. It does not believe in creation. Then the question arises, the population of the world goes on growing. From where all these people are coming? Because there is no sign of any life on any planet, on any star. From where all these people go on coming? At the time of Mahavira, India has only 2 million people. Now there are only in India 900 million people. From where? And not to say anything about the mosquitoes, because they are also having souls according to Mahavira. And bed bugs, and cockroaches, and rats. Just look around the world, all these have souls. From where they are coming? So Mahavira has there his loophole. He fabricates an idea that there is a place called Nigod. Somewhere far away, just as the God is far away. And this Nigod is a place like a ice-cold freezer, where souls are frozen from eternity. infinite souls, so it cannot be a small freezer. Howsoever frozen are the souls, but they will take some space. The freezer has to be big enough to contain millions and millions and millions and trillions of souls. And then those souls start coming one by one. Why one by one? This Nigod is a place absolutely imaginary, just to answer the question from where the souls are coming. Their number goes on growing. If the world is uncreated, and if the people on the earth has remained the same number, there would have been no question. But every day, people are growing. Every moment, every second, thousands of people are coming, and these are only men. What about all other animals, all other insects? They have also souls. According to Mahavira, every living being has a soul, even a tree. So he had to invent finally a lie, that there is somewhere far away place where souls are dormant. So top layer is released, then another layer is released. But who is doing all this work? Who is running the shop? And why some people have come first and some are still in the freezer? And Mahavira has no explanation about it. Every religion, it does not matter what religion is there, you will find, if you search deep enough, however sophisticated it is, there will be a loophole. All religions depend on lies. Zen is not a religion, hence it need not be dependent on lies. It is a pure search. It does not go with any prejudice or any belief in the search. It does not even say that you will find it. One never knows. You just go and see on your own whether there is something inside or not. Although anybody who has gone deep inside has always found, but still Zen continues to be the only approach without any lies. Knowing perfectly well there is a hidden Buddha in you, it does not tell you that you have to believe in it. Search for yourself. It gives such total freedom to you because it does not impose any belief. Hence you cannot find any loophole in Zen. That's its beauty. That's its greatness. The Sutra. One day, on his way to see Matazu, Tanka Tenen met an old man with a boa and asked them where they lived. The old man answered, "Above is the sky, below is the earth." A man of Zen, certainly. He does not answer the question, where does he live? He simply says, above is the sky, below is the earth. What is the point of living anywhere else Everywhere the sky is above and underneath is the earth. So wherever you live between these two things, the sky and the earth. What is the point to make labels that I live here and I live there? Life exists on the earth below the sky. The old man certainly has an insight, but Tankatenen cannot accept so easily. Tanka said, how about if the sky crumbled away and the earth fell to pieces? The old man simply said, ah. The sky crumbling and the earth falling into pieces, what to say except the last ah. But he has proved himself to be really a man of Zen. He did not argue the point. He did not ask how the sky can crumble, how the earth can fall into pieces. No, Zen is not an argument. Zen is a response, is spontaneous. It does not quarrel. It simply states. He accepts what Tanka is saying, maybe. Who knows? The sky one day crumbles. The earth falls into pieces. The old man says, ah. If it happens, then this will be my response. The boy drew a deep breath and Tanka said, if there were no father, no child would be born. The old man and the child entered the mountains and were seen no more. Both proved to be very extraordinary people. The old man certainly, and even the boy. When the old man said, ah, the boy drew a deep breath. If it is going to happen, then the last breath, the last feel of life, the last dance, one breath more. Not asking much. And when Tanka said, if there were no father, no child would be born, they did not say anything. They simply disappeared into the mountains and were seen no more. This is what I am calling freedom from oneself, the Zen manifesto. It is a disappearance into the mountains, it is a disappearance into the ocean, it is a disappearance into the sky, but fundamentally it is a disappearance of the self. Then you are no more seen again. That old man and that young boy both proved correct. Once Tankatenen was lying on the Tenzin Bridge, Lord Tycho, who was in charge of the bridge, came out and warned Tanka that he had better move, but Tanka did not get up. Nobody can order a man of Zen. You can kill, but you cannot order. You can murder, but you cannot command. The man of Zen does not bother about death, because he knows his deathlessness. He does not care about who you are, large or governor or emperor. It does not matter. You are just made of five elements, the earth, the water, the fire. The air, the sky. You are made of five elements just as any beggar. Don't bother me. So Tanaka did not even reply, and he is lying on the bridge, which is not a place to lie down. The Lord said to him that he had better move, but Tanaka Tenen did not get up and did not answer either. Thekko asked why he did not listen to. After a few moments, Tanaka said, "I am a monk of nothing. Who is there to listen? I have searched enough. I don't find anybody to listen. I have found only nothingness. I am a man of nothingness. Don't bother. There is nobody inside me to listen to you or follow to your commandment. I have looked enough, searched enough, every nook and corner. It is pure nothingness. I am nowhere to be found." So whom you are talking? And what do you mean by saying that why you did not listen to me? Neither I am nor you are. Nobody has spoken, nobody has listened. I am a monk of nothing. He is saying, I am a man of Zen. Lord Thekko was taken aback, a very strange man. But it was not a philosophical statement. Tenen was radiant, because he has found he is no more. Only existence expresses itself. He is no more, so existence has taken possession of him. His peace, his silence, his grandeur, his grace comes from existence, because he has allowed. Finding that there is nobody inside, he has opened all the doors, fresh breeze and sun rays, and sometimes the moon looks through the windows. The house is utterly absent of any ego, any self. But a man of such nothingness has a tremendous presence. He has no personality. He has no person. He has no self. But he radiates light. He radiates joy. He radiates a dance around him of subtle energies. Lord Thekko was taken away by Tanaka Tenen's response, and from then on provided him with clothing and a daily meal, and did not ask him to move from the bridge. Tanaka Tenen lived his whole life on that bridge. Finally, the Lord Thekko has to make a hut for him, because there is rain and there is too much sun. And he was just lying down there naked. So he has to arrange for clothes, arrange for his food, finally drop the idea of having a bridge, made a hut in the middle of the bridge. The man was such an impact on him that because of him, the whole city where he was the ruler started venerating Tanaka. He became famous as a very strange man, but a man of truth, honesty, of immense blissfulness. All over him there was a very fine grace pouring to anybody who was receptive, and that is the meaning of veneration. It should not be formal, otherwise you will not be able to understand the man of Zen. Your veneration should be actual, that means you should be receptive to all that he is offering. Not asking for anything, simply offering. You should allow him your inner being, your inner space to fill with his light, to fill with his dance and sound. That's real veneration. Not only in the capital, soon Tanaka was known all over Japan. He was very natural, that's why Matazu has given him the name Tenen. In fact, he was not given him the name, but Tanaka was sitting on the statue of Manjushri, who is known in the history of Buddhas to be one of the most natural beings. Seeing Tanaka sitting on the statue of Manjushri, all the monks could not believe their eyes. What kind of monk he is? He is being disrespectful to one of the great Buddhas. They asked their master Matazu to come and see. One stranger is sitting on top of the statue of Manjushri. Matazu came, saw Tanaka and said, "Ma san, Tenen, my son is very natural." He was sitting there with such natural grace. And Tanaka immediately came down from the statue and said, "This is my initiation name. Now I will be called Tanaka Tenen." So childlike, so natural. He had no teachings. People used to come to him, sit around him. Sometimes he will laugh, and sometimes he will weep. And people ask, "What is the matter? Sometimes you laugh, sometimes you weep," and always the same answer: "I weep for you, I laugh for myself." And he was right, absolutely right. Do you know my tears? I never weep before you. I have to weep under my blanket. I enjoy your laughter, but I know it is still not natural. It is caused by a joke. I would love you to laugh without any cause. Just sheer laughter. Why do you need any cause? Why do you need any excuse? Laughter is simply expression of your health, of your nothingness. Laughter is simply coming from the very sources of existence. The whole existence is full of laughter. You don't hear it because in different ways it laughs. In different ways it dances. In different ways it sings songs of ecstasy. But I feel exactly like Kanka Tenen. A sadness for you because you have not yet become nothingnesses. So his tears were for others, his laughter was coming from his nothingness. And don't see any contradiction. There is no contradiction because tears are for others because they are capable of becoming Buddhas and they are delaying it. And laughter for himself, that how is strange. In this world of insanity, I have become a Buddha. Can you find a greater joke? In this madhouse called the earth, somebody becomes a Gautam Buddha, somebody becomes a Tanka Tenen or a Matasu. Is it not absolutely absurd? There is no reason why. So he is laughing at the strangeness, at the mysterious existence that to some the blossoming comes, and to some only sadness and misery. So his tears were as actual out of his compassion, and his laughter was also actual out of his sheer joy. Seeing that he has arrived, while others are simply going in circles. There is a special spider in South Africa. It is very man-like. Its behavior is very human. It always follows the leader. You will find thousands of spiders in a line. Just if somebody ahead of them is moving, they are moving. One scientist who was researching about this strange behavior of leadership and followers, he put a round glass table with raised corners like a plate and put the leader and went on putting other spiders behind and behind and behind till the circle was complete. They started moving round and round because now there was nowhere to go and there was no way to stop because the person ahead was moving until they all died, just utterly exhausted. But they did not stop till they have the last breath. They went on and on and on. And finally they all died one by one. The older ones died first, then the younger became old, they died. And the children became older and they died. After 7 days, that whole plate was full of dead spiders. And the scientist who was working on them said that it is very human. That's how human beings are behaving. Somebody is following Jesus Christ, not knowing who is this fellow. Is he sane? Have you ever wondered? All his behavior looks eccentric. His declarations, fanatic. Only an insane man can make those statements. But millions and millions of people are following him down the centuries. 20 centuries have passed. How many millions of people have died following him? They don't know where he is going, who he is. This is the way of believers. Zen is not for believers. It is for discoverers. It is not for retarded people who won't even take the risk of thinking whom they are following and why. Why are you a Hindu? Just because accidentally you were born in a Hindu family. That accident is deciding your destiny. Why are you a Christian? But nobody ever wonders. Thinking seems to be a difficult task because it gives you a great disappointment. It takes away your lies and suddenly you feel you are naked. It takes away your consolations and suddenly you fall into insecurity. So it is better to keep eyes closed, tightly closed, in case they open themselves in some moment when you are not alert enough to keep them tight closed. This way, one blind man follows another blind man, not knowing where the first one is going, and first one is almost dead. 2,000 years have passed. And people are still following the dead. Not only the blind, but the blind who have been dead for 2,000 years or 5,000 years. Zen brings you to ask that to be accidental is not your destiny. To be existential is to be your destiny. So draw following. Just stand on your own feet and look inwards. Following is always looking outwards. Look inwards. And you will find eternal peace. Of course, in that eternal peace, you have to disappear. But it is a sheer joy to disappear. To be is a tension. Not to be is a relaxation. A haiku, an old pine tree preaches wisdom, and a wild bird is crying out truth. Just you have to be alert enough, and you will find whole nature is full of wisdom, and the whole existence is crying out truth from different sources. An old pine tree preaches wisdom, and a wild bird is crying out truth. A very significant haiku. Just you need open eyes, receptivity, sensitivity, awareness, and this whole existence becomes your home. Zen is concerned absolutely with your relaxedness, because only in relaxedness one has sunken deep enough into the original sources of life, and there he finds such joy. Who cares whether one is or is not? The joy is, life is, existence is, enlightenment is. It is the poverty of language that we have to call a man enlightened. Because when enlightenment happens, the man disappears. Then there is only enlightenment. You cannot call Gautam Buddha an enlightened person because the person is no more there. Only when the person is no more there, there is enlightenment, a complete luminous existence. From every nook and corner, wisdom is flowing towards you. From every bird, truth is proclaimed. From every flower, beauty is proclaimed. From every mountain, from every river, thousands and thousands of glories. The whole existence becomes a totally different phenomenon the moment you disappear. Hence, you are the only problem. If you can dissolve your problem, it means you have to dissolve yourself. So there is no salvation for you. There is only dissolving yourself into the ultimate. And there is nothing more greater, nothing more majestic, nothing more miraculous. This dissolving is the manifesto of Zen. Manisha's question. Thomas Merton wrote, If a Christian mystic has an experience which can be phenomenologically compared with a Zen experience, does it matter that the Christian in fact believes he is personally united with God, and the Zen man interprets his experience as sunyata, nothingness, or the void being aware of himself? In what sense can these two experiences be called mystical? Beloved Master, why do so many Christians and admirers of Zen try to make the two fit together? Because they cannot drop their old prison. They have become so accustomed to it. And these two experiences cannot be compared. These two experiences are so far away from each other as a lie and a truth. The God-oriented religions Thomas Merton mentions Christianity because he is a Christian, but you can see his statement begins with a if. And whenever there is a if, there is no direct experience. If a Christian mystic, in the first place, it is a if. If a Christian mystic has an experience, no Christian mystic can have such an experience which can be phenomenologically compared with a Zen experience. No, absolutely no. No Christian can ever experience phenomenologically something equal to Zen experience, because the foundations of their search are totally different. Does it matter that the Christian in fact believes he is personally united? Yes, it matters. To be personally united with a God is a fiction. The man is living in a hallucination. It is not the experience of truth. It is the experience projected by a belief system in a particular God. And there are thousands of gods around, not only the Christian God. So everybody can choose. They come in all sizes and all shapes. It is a commodity. You can purchase from the marketplace a Buddha, a Jesus on the cross, a Krishna playing on his flute, and you can worship them. And if you go on worshipping them, you are really programming your memory continuously. Soon, you will start having delusions. A Christian or a Hindu or a Mohammedan cannot have any experience equivalent to the Zen experience. It is not a question of language only. That's what Merton is trying to do. He is saying that it is only linguistically different. They are using different language, but the experience is same. If it was same, why Merton was trying to go to Japan? What was the need? A Zen master has never been known to have gone to a Christian monastery. There is no need. He is consoling himself and other Christians that don't be worried. Phenomenologically, your experience can be compared to the Zen experience of nothingness. No, it cannot be compared, because your experience is not of nothingness. Your experience is of a God which is filling your nothingness, which is a barrier against nothingness. Your God has to be removed. And rather than removing Him, you are filling an identity with God. You are becoming one with the God. You are hallucinating. You are dreaming with open eyes. The Zen experience of sunyata, of nothingness, is not a mind projection. Mind cannot project only one thing, and that is nothingness. This has to be understood. Mind can project everything. It cannot project only one thing, nothingness. Because in trying to project nothingness, mind will have to empty itself completely. And the emptying of the mind completely, mind will disappear. Mind is nothing but thoughts put together. We call 5 persons living in a house a family. Just take those 5 persons out, and where is the family? Family was only a collective name. We call a certain group of people Rotary Club. Take out one by one members, and then find out whether Rotary Club is still inside the house. There is no one. Mind is a collective name of all your thoughts. If you go on emptying mind to create something equal to nothingness, then God will have to be dropped out. It is a thought. Then heaven and hell will be dropped out. They are thoughts. Once you create the mind which has no thoughts, you have transcended mind. There is no mind anymore. You have entered into nothingness. But you will not find a God waiting there and hugging you. And remember always, if any God hugs you, it is dangerous. Because that fellow who has created this whole universe must not be of your size. He will be huge. You will be simply killed like a mosquito. Avoid any such experience. Nothingness is good. You will disappear in both the cases. In one you will be murdered, in another you will simply disperse. But dispersing yourself is a beautiful experience. Being murdered is a very ugly, torturous experience. These two experiences cannot be compared. There is no question at all. But it is not only Thomas Merton. Many other Christians are trying to do the same. Christianity is feeling that its moment to disappear has come. It has no reason now to remain in existence. It has lost its roots. It was perfectly okay for the uneducated, uncultured, uncivilized slaves. Now man is coming of age. Christianity was good for children to play with, a good toy. God was a toy. But the man, when he comes of age, does not need a toy. He needs something real. Zen is for those who are intelligent, mature, who are no more childish, grown-ups. It needs daring. It needs throwing away all kinds of slaveries. And all religions are nothing but very cunning ways to make humanity reduced into indignity, humiliation and slavery. Now Christianity is trying hard somehow to survive. Thomas Merton's statement is simply a desire somehow to keep God and God-oriented religion to remain in the future also. And he sees a way, if it can be compared, that these both experiences, the experience of a Zen man and the experience of a Christian mystic, are just the same, only their language differs, then there is a possibility for Christianity and the God to dominate still. But they cannot be compared. They are not only different, they are opposite to each other. One is a lie, another is a truth. God is a fiction, Sunnita is the ultimate experience. There is no way for Christianity to survive. It's so certainly that Christians are aware of their death, which is coming closer and closer every moment. They know their God is dead, and they are keeping that God an artificial breathing system. And they are looking all over the world if some props can be found. So God can look as if He is still alive. Hindus are not in such a search because they are not so sophisticated and they are not so alert. Neither Jainas are in such a frantic search because they are not so sophisticated and they are not so much interested. Their interest is much in money. Just one Japanese newspaper wrote an article about me and wondered what is the matter. Indians are coming to Japan to learn technology, particularly the latest discoveries in electronics. Japan has become now the most sophisticated technological country, the richest country in the world. Even America is poorer now. Japan is 4 times richer than America. And it is 4 times smaller than America. So it is a miracle that Japan has done. And after the destruction of the Second World War, suddenly a tremendous outburst of energy. So Indians are going to Tokyo, and the article mentions, and Japanese are going to Pune. You are all coming from Western countries, or from Eastern countries which have become richer enough. Japan, Taiwan, soon people from Korea will be here. And Indians are rushing all over the world to America, to Britain, to Germany, to learn new technology, to be more scientific. And India still goes on claiming that it is one of the most spiritual countries. My foot. It is the most unspiritual country in the world. Gone are those days when it used to be spiritual. 25 centuries have passed. But the old fog remains around the mind. Otherwise, India is more attached to things, attached to money, attached to power, is more ambitious to have domination, prestige, respectability than any other country. And you are the proof. Whenever I say anything, I have the proof. You are here because you know money is not going to help. It is not going to bring your ultimate blasphemy. It can buy everything, but it cannot buy Buddhahood. It can buy everything, human beings included. But it cannot buy meditation. You have to go alone on the path . Richer countries are frustrated, utterly frustrated, because they have found money and they have found respectability. They are educated, they are sophisticated, they are intellectually far more advanced than the backward countries. Naturally, Christianity is the only religion in the world who is becoming aware that their congregation is disappearing. They are all going to Pune. You don't see many Indians here, very few. Very few those who are intelligent enough. But it is really sad. The country of Gautam Buddha is no more interested in meditation. It is interested in bringing more technology, more riches. And most of the people who go outside to learn technology never return. Just as you would not like to return. Because there they get more money. A doctor can earn more in Germany or Japan. In America, a professor can earn more. A scientist is needed more in those countries. In India, he will be at the most the middle class. He cannot think of being super rich, but in Japan or Germany or America, he can have the ambition of becoming super rich. So those who go forever. There was another article few months before in a German magazine that what is happening? German youth simply goes to Pune and then they are never seen again. It is the difficulties created by the barriers of nations . You cannot stay more than 3 months, more than 6 months at the most. So you have to go and come back again. If these barriers disappear, Pune is going to become a country in itself. But it will be a foreign country to India. It will be one of the most cosmopolitan world in itself. It is because of this Christianity is more alert and is trying to survive. Hindus are perfectly asleep. Although they are going to drown, they are in the same boat in which Christianity is, in the same boat. Hindus are sleeping in the same boat, Jainas are sleeping in the same boat, Mohammedans are sleeping, but they are sleeping. At least the Christian is looking all around, the boat is drowning. And he is trying somehow to save the God-oriented theology. But it cannot be saved. It has already outlived its time. It should be graceful for it to disappear. It is now ugly, becoming more and more ugly, to enforce itself and pretend that we are alive. If your God is dead, you cannot be alive. You have died with your God. I offer you resurrection. But in resurrection, you will not be Christians. You will not be Hindus. You will not be Mohammedans. In resurrection, you will be men of Zen. Hence, the Zen manifesto. The world needs it immediately, urgently. Now put on the lights. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Let the Christian ship drown. You have found something alive. You can laugh and you can dance and you can celebrate. One afternoon, Miss Pinky Dicky, the librarian, comes into Dr. Chaff's office with a small growth on her cheek. Dr. Chaff examines the little blemish carefully and then prescribe some green pills. There you are, Miss Dicky, says Chop Off. It is what I think it is. That should take care of it. But 2 weeks later, Pinky is back in the doctor's office. This time a small wooden twig has sprouted out of the growth on her cheek. Interesting, says Dr. Chop Off. If it is what I think it is, these should take care of it. And he gives her a bottle of blue pills. But 2 weeks later, Pinky is back. This time the twig has grown into a branch with leaves and flowers on it. The doctor examines it very carefully and then says, interesting. If it is what I think it is, then these should take care of it, be sure. And he gives Pinky a bottle of red pills. But 1 month later, Miss Pinky Dicky is back in Dr. Chopoff's office. Doctor, she cries, look at me now. The doctor is shocked to see Pinky barely able to get through the door. Because she now has a small tree growing out of her head. Says Chop Off, a rare and interesting case. If it is what I think it is, these should certainly take care of it. And he hands her some green and purple spotted pills. For 6 months, Dr. Chop Off does not hear anything from Miss Dicky. Then one day the door of his office bursts off its hinges and Pinky Dicky comes staggering in. The doctor cannot believe his eyes. He can hardly see Pinky underneath the huge apple tree. Flowering bushes, large rocks, and a bubbling waterfall coming out of her head. Help me, doctor, she cries, what is it? Aha, explains Dr. Chop Off. Now I know what it is. It is a beauty spot. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the doctor rings in the office of Dr. Floss, the dentist. Hello, says Floss. Hello, says Wu, the Chinaman. What time you fixy teeth for me? 2:30, replies Floss. All right? Yes, says Wu. 2:30. All right. But what time you fixy? There is a huge explosion at the scientific laboratory and Professor Teddy Test Tube, the scientist, is blown through the window and knocked unconscious. When Teddy wakes up, he is dazed and confused. But he has a sudden flash of inspiration. He decides to devote the rest of his life to the alchemy of turning regular house bricks into gold bricks. For 10 years, Teddy works hard on his project until one day he gets stuck. Cries Teddy to Igor, his lab assistant. Just one little answer to one question, Igor, and we will be rich. But night after night, Teddy's experiments are fruitless. Finally, utterly exhausted and nearly burnt out, Teddy is slumped across his workbench when Igor comes in. Don't give up, Professor Test Tube, exclaims Igor. I have an idea. Why don't you go and see Madame Weir, the wise woman of Tibet? he will be able to answer your burning question. Great idea. Sounds steady, jumping up. And he goes and packs his bags and leaves for Tibet the next morning. After a long camel ride from Kathmandu, Teddy finally arrives, tired and exhausted, on the doorsteps of Madame Weir's mountain retreat. The question is still burning in his mind, but Teddy is told he must purify himself before he is granted an audience with the wise woman. So for 3 days he is forced to live on a diet of aqua guard, water and rafu tofu. Finally, he is admitted into Madame Weir's private bed chamber. "Welcome, stranger," greets Madame Weir, sprawled across the huge bed in her see-through negligee. Teddy is shocked and a little nervous, seeing such a beautiful woman way out here in the middle of nowhere. "I can receive you today," smiles Madame Weir, "because your energy is sufficiently pure. And besides that, my husband has gone to the village for some monkey business. But I can answer one question only, and no more." Perspiring, Teddy loosens his collar as he stares at her beautiful, bulging breasts bursting through her see-through negligee. There is much moving of eyeballs and raising of eyebrows as Madame Beard beckons Teddy to come closer. "Go ahead," she says in a throaty voice, "ask your burning question." "Okay," blurts out Teddy, "tell me one thing, when your husband will be back?" Nivedana. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to enter into your inner world. Gather all your energy, your total consciousness, and rush towards the center of your being. It is exactly 2 inches below your navel inside. A great urgency is needed, as if it is going to be your last moment. Faster, with great intensity, rush faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you are coming closer to the center of your being, a great silence descends over you, just like soft rain falling. You can feel the coolness. The whole night is becoming silent with you. A little more closer to the center, and you are surrounded in a cloud of peace. Peace that passeth understanding. Move a little more closer, and you feel great blissfulness you have not known before. A tremendous power which is harmless. A light that is filling your very being. You are luminous in this luminosity. You can see the center perfectly well. Step into the center and you will start feeling a divine drunkenness, a great ecstasy. You have heard these words. This is direct experience. Here you will find your original face, the face of Gautam the Buddha has been accepted in the East as a symbol of everybody's original face. Everybody is born with the potential of becoming a Buddha. As you step into the center, you disappear. Only the Buddha remains, only your awareness, alertness, consciousness. Buddha has only one quality. That is the very meaning of the name Buddha, witnessing. Witness, you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. And finally witness that you are only a witness. And suddenly, a door opens into the cosmos. You see from where your life has been coming. You see you are no more, only existence is. This pure nothingness, this sunyata, is the only religious experience there is. To make your witnessing deeper, Nivedana, relax, sink into your very sources of life, dissolve yourself in this ocean of consciousness. Gautam the Buddha auditorium is turning into an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas are disappearing into one oceanic feeling, into one oceanic experience. This is pure Zen. This is the beginning of an endless journey. Gautam Buddha is reported to have said, Ignorance has no beginning but an end. Enlightenment has a beginning but no end. You are taking the first step into enlightenment. These are the three steps. The first step is you will find Gautam Buddha as your shadow. But very luminous, very solid, almost tangible. You will feel a tremendous compassion surrounding you. In the second step, Buddha will come in front of you and you will become his shadow. Your shadow, of course, is dark. It is only a false entity. As the Buddha becomes more and more radiant in front of you, your shadow starts dissolving. The second step is followed by the third. Your shadow has dissolved into the Buddha. Only a pure witnessing Buddha remains, utterly transparent, so he cannot make any shadow. This is your pure life eternal. This life is cosmic. You have entered into the womb of existence. You are no more, on the one hand, on the other hand, you are all that is alive, and the whole existence is alive, throbbing. You can hear existence heartbeat. You are so close to it. Now gather all these experiences, the bliss, the ecstasy, the peace, the silence, the serenity, and persuade the Buddha to come behind you. He has to become a constant companion to you in your acts, in your gestures, in your day-to-day affairs. This is the first step. Second and third will follow in their own time. You have just to wait in deep trust. If the first has happened, the second is bound to happen. It is really the growth of the first. And the third is the growth of the second. And the third is the final step. Once you have become enlightened, you are free from birth and death, you are free from all bondages, you are even free from your oneself. This is the ultimate freedom. Freedom from oneself. And only a man who has attained the ultimate freedom can dance. There will be no dancer but only dance. Can celebrate. But now celebration will be arising from the very depths of existence itself. Can laugh. Now it will be a totally different laughter. It will be existence laughing through you. All your actions will become existential. They will have a great grace and duty and truth and authenticity. Nivedana, now come back and bring all these experiences and the Buddha following you with great grace, with silence. Sit down for a few moments just to remember the golden path that you have followed. And the opening into ultimate space, into nothingness, into sunyata. And the great moment when you had disappeared and only existence was there. Soon it will become your 24-hour experience. Inch by inch, you will be transformed into a Gautam Buddha. That is everybody's birthright.